Greetings, podcast listeners. You've tuned in to another episode of the Something Beautiful podcast right here on your iPod or your favorite listening device. We appreciate you joining us. This week, we have a special treat for you. We have Adele Sackler, a dear friend of the podcast. We'll be chatting with her friend, Pete Rollins. This interview actually took place back in March or April of this year, right before Pete's latest book, The Orthodox Heretic, came out. And they sat down and chatted for an hour or so. And I was able to get this audio from Adele earlier this week, and we wanted to be sure and share it with our listeners here on the podcast. So definitely appreciate Adele sitting down with Pete and chatting, and Pete taking the time to do that, and also for both of them being willing to share the audio right here on our podcast. So stay tuned. Right after this, we will have Adele Sackler and Pete Rollins on the Something Beautiful podcast.
You're listening to Something Beautiful, part of the Emergent Podcast Network. For more information about this and other great shows, visit us online at www.emergentpodcast.com.
If you have any questions or comments about this show, we do encourage you to drop us a line. You can email us, somethingbeautifulpodcast@gmail.com, or call our listener line, 972-535-8980. 972-535-8980, or anywhere in the world if you're on Skype, simply Skype J.D. Blundell, and you can find a link to that right on our podcast page at www.somethingbeautifulpodcast.com.
Hi, this is Adele, and I'm sitting here with Pete Rollins, my good friend, who spent the weekend here in Richmond, Virginia, and we're just going to have a little chat and hope you enjoy this. Thanks, Pete, for doing this with me.
Thanks very much. Great to be here in Richmond.
It's great to have you. The other night, you were talking about God and the world and how people have enjoyed your work because it's made a place for doubt, complexity, ambiguity. And I'm wondering if this is something you're happy with. And then you went the other night at Baptist Theological Seminary and expanded on a little bit that the idea that how God is, how he exists, how we should live as God exists, and that our churches actually should be a place where we come and we can express and experience the doubt, the questioning, the ambiguities. Could you expand on that some more?
Yeah, I guess whenever How Not to Speak of God came out, I was concerned because I noticed that quite a few people said, oh, you know, enjoyed the book. I love this idea of doubt, and I love that there's complexity and ambiguity in faith, and they really resonated with that. And then when I watched them, I realized that when they went to church, they actually sang songs that were full of certainty, that the sermons were all full of kind of conviction, that the prayers and the liturgies were all these affirmations. And so while they were on a personal subjective level saying, oh yeah, my faith is riven with doubt, their practices were all about still certainty, knowing, and a certain triumphalism. And this was kind of frustrating for me because my project, and this is what I'm working on at the moment, is kind of to turn that on its head. While I embrace doubt, complexity and ambiguity and faith, my point is not that that doubt should exist in our grounded day-to-day life and then we go to church and we express certainty. Rather, my argument is that in our day-to-day life, we should live as though God exists. We should fight for justice. We should fight for our political and goals, for freedom, for those who are oppressed, for those who are on their knees. We should be a voice to those who are voiceless. And actually, when we go to church, we should there, in that space, be able to explore our doubts and uncertainties. In other words, church, the song shouldn't all be Jesus, my boyfriend. Some of the songs should be about anger at God. Some of them should be expressing doubts. Some of them should be expressing sorrow and pain and suffering. And that should also be expressed in the sermons. It should also be expressed in the prayers and the liturgies. So instead of believing in church and not believing when it comes to living in the world, I'm trying to argue that we should be believing in the world and doubting when we go to church.
And why do you think people who read your books, especially How Not to Speak of God, why are they getting it, but then they're not getting it? Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I think, I mean, a part of the problem is how we conceive of God in the contemporary church and contemporary philosophy. Basically, God became an answer to our questions. Very basically, whenever we faced suffering or uncertainty or we were scared of what happened after death, the answer was God. The answer was Jesus. And we went into churches, people would try to say, you know, if you think that life is meaningless, you know, life has meaning. God is the meaning. Now, there are lots of problems with this. For one, it makes God into something that we use selfishly. You know, I'm scared that there's suffering in the world, and so I embrace God. I'm scared that there's no meaning, so therefore I embrace God. And what happens is, I embrace God not because I have been seduced or transformed, but simply because of what God can do. There's the old story about two guys who are going to an Episcopal church, or going past an Episcopal church, and there's a big sign saying, convert to Christianity and get $200. And so they think this is brilliant. They go, right, we don't have any money, we want to go down to the pub, have a few drinks. So one of them says to the other, you go in, do the whole, you know, conversion thing, get the $200, we'll go and get a few drinks at the pub. So the other guy laughs, says, absolutely, no problems, goes into the church. By half an hour later, he comes out, $200 in his back pocket. And his friend looks at him and says, did you get the money? And his other friend just, like, looks disapprovingly, puts his hand on the other guy's shoulder and says, is money all you non-Christians think about? You know, the idea that you could go in selfishly wanting $200 and then be transformed? Of course not. So if someone goes into a church and selfishly wants meaning, can they be transformed by that? Or is that not God externally imposed as an answer to a question? And the problem is, what we do is we make God the answer to every question. You know the story of the minister who's doing a children's address, and he says, what's brown, furry, eats nuts and climbs trees? The wee girl at the front puts her hands up and says, Mister, I know the answer's Jesus, but it sure sounds like a squirrel. You know, this is what we do. We make all of the answers, the questions people have, the answer is Jesus. Yeah, that's why G.K. Chesterton says, every time a man knocks on the door of a brothel, he's looking for God. Mm. Now, that might be a nice quote, but it's no more true than the Freudian response, which we know, every time a man knocks on the doors of a church, he's looking for sex. Mm. You know, who knows? But the point is, and the point I'm trying to make is this way, so God becomes an intellectual answer to a question. And it happens in philosophy with Descartes and Kant as well. And then, all Christianity is a way of making us feel good, that we're going to go to heaven when we die, or that life makes sense, and doesn't necessarily transform our inner existence, doesn't make us more into the way of Christ. And when
it's
that
only
happens,
a band-aid, would you say? It's like a band-aid?
Yeah, God becomes a guarantee that the world is meaningful. And that's why Nietzsche said God is dead, because he says, your God has just become an idea. You're a practical unbeliever. You may be a theoretical believer. You believe in your head, but you don't believe in your life. You're no different from anybody else. It says, that God has no performative power. That God is nothing. That God is just an idea. And so what happens with that is, we don't change. We live in the world as if everything's the same. You know, we're no different from anybody else. We're trying to be loving parents. We try to, you know, do well in our job. We try to get our promotions. But then we go to church, and in church we affirm the certainty that everything's going to be okay. And that's what needs to be changed. And it's such a big thing that it's, you know, it's a big project, because our churches are so immersed in that kind of thinking. But the saint of this movement is someone like Mother Teresa. Mother Teresa believed in her life, in her flesh. It was incarnated Christianity. Yes. And yet when she died, we realised that she was full of doubts, full of uncertainties, not sure if God was there. And so she was able to doubt at this level while believe at a grounded level.
It's like we were talking before, that you're transformed, you're seduced by the divine, and it impacts you in a way that you necessarily don't know how to explain, but you know it's doing something. That's why you don't give up on God.
Absolutely. I mean, this is why I argue that fundamentalism isn't too violent. It's actually not violent enough. And the reason why I say that is because fundamentalism, although subjectively violent, you know, it can be misogynistic, it can be homophobic, it can be, you know, advocating selfish foreign policy. It actually, it gives God as an answer to a question. And so you change your thinking, But actually, and you go to your church and you engage in some sort of kind of certain projects, but it doesn't necessarily change what coffee you drink. It doesn't change what clothes you buy, what house you live in, what car you drive. It's violent at the subjective level, but it doesn't transform the structures of society themselves. Whereas a true violence of someone like Mother Teresa, she was a pacifist and she lived this beautiful life, but it was truly violent because her way of treating the children around her questioned the caste system. It actually just fundamentally questioned the structure of the society she was in. Mm. Or Martin Luther King, the way he lived fundamentally challenged the racist structures that existed in America at the time through their lives. That's the violence of Christianity. Not a subjective violence that hurts people, but a violence that brings real change.
A revolution.
A revolution.
Mm. Or a rupture, like what you would call a rupture, or a...
Yeah, it lives the impossible. It creates what can be called TAZ moments. A TAZ is a temporary autonomous zone. A guy called Hacken Bay talks about this. And a flash mob is an example of a TAZ moment, where maybe 300 people show up in a public place with their headphones on, and they dance to a song for 3 minutes, and then they all disperse. Or a pile of people, you know, turn up in the underground with no trousers on, and then go down two stops and some people are giving out free trousers, and then it disappears. These little moments that happen, and then before you even realise it, they're gone. But little moments that live some sort of alternative, that question your everyday reality, that everyone stops and goes, what's happening? And it takes you out of your everyday mundane existence just for a moment. Now, for me, the kingdom of God, we instantiate that in little ways, living an alternative way of being. They can never be fully realised. You know, that if they're there for too long, they get colonised, they get taken over, they become something less. Mm-hmm. But for these little moments, we live an alternative. We live the kingdom, these little Taz moments. And in doing that, we challenge the very core and structures of society, not directly challenging Caesar, but indirectly just living an alternative.
Where I think a lot of Christians, they are not doubting in church, and then necessarily they're not doubting out in their life. They're trying to take what they live in their church out and put that on society at large. Mm-hmm. Yours is just a whole upside down way of thinking.
Yep.
And looking at it, and I think sometimes that scares people. I think they're probably inside maybe thinking and doubting, but to express that outwardly, I know for me, mm-hmm. I feared to express that outwardly for fear that people would think I was off my rocker or I would be rejected. Or
yeah, yep. Absolutely. And what many of us do is we believe through our rituals and through the pastor. So a whole church can be doubting, but if the pastor doubts, there's a crisis in the church. Because what we're doing is we're believing through the other. There's an old psychoanalytic joke that a guy I read, Slavoj Žižek, tells, where this guy thinks he's corn, pieces of corn, and he goes to a psychoanalyst, and he goes for 3 years, and finally, after 3 years of analysis, he realises he's not pieces of corn, he's a human being. That's great. But 3 weeks later, he's back at the analyst's office, he's crying, he's in a sweat, and the analyst goes, what's wrong? And he said, my next door neighbour's got chickens. And he said, I'm terrified they're going to eat me. And the analyst goes, what? He says, you know you're not corn, you know you're a human being. And the guy says, well, I know I'm a human being, but do the chickens know? Right? Right. The idea being that I know that I'm a human being, but you've got to convince the chickens. In other words, I know that fashion's shallow. You've got to convince the fashion magazines. I know that I should be kinder to the poor, but you've got to convince not me of that. I know that. I know having a bigger car won't be good for the soul or for the environment. But I act as though it is. Whenever I leave the conversation, I act as if it is. We believe through the structures that are around us. For me, the church, and we believe through the structures of the church. So if you want to change people, you've got to change the very structures themselves. The liturgies we say, the songs we sing, the way the pews sit. You don't have to convince me. You've got to convince the structures. And that's where my project is going.
Wow. Do you find, even in the midst of people reading your stuff and going, yeah, shaking their head, yeah, I get it, but then they're not going back, maybe it's not changing? Do you think it's a matter of them needing to hear it more? Or what do you think will be that breakthrough that will shake up those structures?
That's a tough one because you can, it's we can subjectively agree with some of this stuff, and yet our objective structures, the structures that we engage in, where we house our belief, doesn't change at all. And so I can speak in a place, and everyone can be nodding their head and agreeing with what's being said, and yet we immediately go into praise and worship afterwards, which is all about affirming the absolute conviction, you know, that God exists and everything's going to be fine in the world. And here's my problem. Even if we can have certainty, right? Even if we can kind of have some sort of epistemological insight into the universe and into God, and you know, so putting aside all the philosophical and theological issues, and say, the question is this: do most people today? Can most people today get to that point? My friends, for example, if it's required to have that type of certainty before you can be part of church, will they be able to be reached? And I go, a lot of my friends now are well-educated, who have access to so much information, who encounter people who think differently from them all the time. It's hard for them to go, all right, so I have to believe in these doctrines and creeds of being absolutely certain about them in order to enter into your church. The problem is, they're just not going to be able to swallow that. And the question we have to ask is, well, do they have to? Or actually, can the church accommodate all of that doubt if they want to live in the way of Christ, if they want to be brought into a place where the transformation can take place?
Yeah.
And that's my wager, is that we can literally have churches that exist beyond belief, where there's not only difference of belief, liberals and conservatives sitting mm-hmm. side by side, right? That's one issue. But also we can have churches where we can express doubts and uncertainties.
Yeah, that's kind of why we haven't found a church, because one, it's boring, you know. Two, it is singing songs, praise and worship songs about Jesus is my homeboy or Jesus is my boyfriend and all this feel good love. And then it's a 3-point sermon. And my experience, even with what you call emerging or emergent kind of communities here in the States, are just a little bit more radical forms of evangelical churches. My experience,
right,
you know,
right,
it's they're being different, they're exploring things, but they're really not stepping outside of a box like my experience with Icon was.
Right.
And and then I have the added component that I'm gay, so not every place is embracing of me.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of, my community has become online through Twitter, Facebook, and blogging, and I just, I hope that things would change, and those churches that are more maybe embracing in that, but they're still in their structures, like Catholic Church or Episcopal churches, it's very boring to me, it's very rigid,
mm-hmm.
and in their rituals, and I think that we are, I think you mentioned this the other night at Baptist Theological Seminary, that we in the States are like a good 10 to 15 or 20 years behind the UK in where churches are. And that's more of where, I guess, you're talking about your upcoming pub tour, how you'd like to explore that more in the United States. Could you talk a little more about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, whenever I say, you know, and the US is 10, 15 years behind in terms of where we are, what I mean is in terms of where we are in secularization.
Yes.
That in many respects, Europe secularized earlier than the US.
Yes.
So in Europe, you will find most of my friends, you know, for example, don't believe in God. Whereas in the US, still in a lot of places I've been, the majority of people, at least verbally, affirm the existence of God. That, I'm guessing, will change and is changing. And in 20, 30, 40 years, it may look a little bit more like a lot of Europe. And the question for me then is, how do churches and can churches create spaces for those people who don't believe or who doubt, in the same way that it can create space for people who do believe?
Yeah.
That can sound like a very strange question to some people in the US, but it actually makes perfect sense back home, where we create a community of theist and atheist, liberal, conservative, Protestant, Catholic, all coming together, all exploring faith and life together. That's why we run the Omega course. The Omega course in Icon is like the Alpha course in reverse. It's exiting Christianity in 12 weeks. And what we do is we create a space where people can ask any questions they want, express their doubts, ambiguities and uncertainties. And you see, what we find is there are worship leaders do that course, pastors, elders have done that course. And it's really a place where we can exit toxic religion and express our doubts. And the truth of the matter is, these people have all of these doubts. This worship leader says, I've been doing worship for 40 years. I love it. I love being part of my local church. She works for a coffee shop where all the profits go to charity, where all of the products are fair trade. And she says, you know, at the moment, I just really find it hard to believe that Jesus rose from the dead. Just find it hard, just where I am at the moment. And then somebody else at the other side of the room says, oh, I really believe that Jesus did rise from the dead and you know, was testified to in the Bible or whatever. And then somebody says, I'm not sure what I think. But the issue is not what was said, but the fact that we could all say it.
Exactly.
And nobody was kind of taking notes and going, oh my goodness, so you should step down. Because that place, that Omega course, can cradle and contain us. We all are friends. We all share ritual and life together. And we can embrace each other's doubts. For me, that should be what church is like.
I agree, but why do you think people are so afraid to take that step?
Well, I mean, it's so much easier to make a Christianity where you can have certain beliefs. I mean, that's much easier to be able to tick certain boxes and know that you're okay. Is for some people, you know, much easier. That's why missions. That's why membership courses are often to do with what you believe. You know, you don't get very many churches which say to be a member of this church, if you have two coats, you have to give one to the poor. I'm not saying one's right and one's wrong. I'm just kind of going, it's interesting that our membership is almost always a list of beliefs that you tick.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting to me. It's much easier to do that than, you know, if you have two cars, you know, you give one away. You know, that you should drive a small car, that you should have you shouldn't have a house with lots of bedrooms that you're not giving to those who are poor. You know, whatever it is. Now, I wouldn't be able to go to a church like that because or I'd find it very difficult because it would challenge me. But I'm much happier to go to a church where I can just tick a few boxes. But it's easier for us. It's easier for us.
Yeah, I think if my thoughts have been what I've been thinking through is that. If churches don't start creating places for people to have these doubts and these questions and to live in the ambiguities, I think we are going to end up in a post-Christian society, a secularized society, because even in emerging church circles, I'll talk to people and they're like, well, it's the structures, you know, people are fighting against. They really want to know Jesus. But I come across people all the time that really don't even want anything to do with Jesus because... It's not Jesus himself. I think it's the things we've put on Jesus,
mm-hmm.
our subjective thoughts and beliefs on Jesus, and has made Jesus toxic.
Yes, absolutely. And now people are very, very put off. Yeah, absolutely. And the thing that I need to be clear about, and this is very, very key, especially in relation to how my books have been received. My point is not that we doubt whenever we go out into the world and we just live... We live as though God doesn't exist and all of that. No, my point is that we live as though God exists. We take action as though God exists. We rely more on the idea that God exists than we do on our jobs. And we take the big risks in our lives. We take the big steps. We make the big sacrifices as if God is there. And then we go into church and we express all our doubts and uncertainties. This is not for me a call to not act. For me, we need to act. We need to, you know, and that is what Pascal understood. He said, oh, you believe in God? All right, okay. But do you act as though God exists? You know, oh, you're an agnostic? Oh, that's interesting. But do you act as though God exists? Oh, you're an atheist? Oh, that's interesting. Do you act as though God exists? In other words, Pascal was going, do you pray, serve the poor, engage in meditation and prayer and these activities? Do you live as though God exists? That's it. It's incarnated. And there are people like Mother Teresa, like Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who are the people who show what this looks like. They show what this looks like. This is possible.
Then would you say then, when we live in those doubts, ambiguities, like the places where that worship leader questioned, I don't know if I believe the resurrection happened, because we're being honest and we're putting it out there, then that is a place then where transformation can also occur because we're being honest.
Yes, and this is very important for me. I mean, we think today that Christianity is a worldview. This is massive, especially in the US, that Christianity is a form of belief. It's a hermeneutic. In other words, when you're a Christian, you have a certain cosmology and anthropology. You have a certain way of looking at the universe. You have a certain way of thinking about human beings. And so Christianity is kind of a form of a Gnostic religion. It has a certain set of knowledge claims that you need to accept and embrace, and it's a gnosis. Now, what I'm saying is actually I think fundamentally Christianity is not hermeneutical. It's not a worldview. But actually fundamentally Christianity is about a transformed mode of being where we are literally reborn. Or we are, literally is maybe not the right word, that something reconfigures us, we are transformed. And so in churches, rather than it being a place where we get information, where the pastor is some sort of expert who gives us knowledge. Now in the past that might have been the case, because in the past the pastor might have been the most educated person in the congregation, the only person who'd gone to university. But today, often the congregation, half of the people would have more educational understanding mm-hmm. than the pastor. So the role of the pastor is not to be the expert giving us some sort of knowledge. The role of the pastor is to help create a space where we lay down our understandings and interpretations, and we allow that event to take place. We invite and we solicit this transformative event, this Christ moment to happen in our lives.
Does it go along then with what you talked about yesterday at St. Andrew's Episcopal Church when you were talking about being a leader? Is that kind of what the idea? You're a leader, but you're not a leader.
Yeah, you're a leader who refuses to lead. Yes. And what I mean by that is that, we have this natural desire. We want a leader that we can dominate. That's what we want. We want a leader who'll tell us what we want to hear, but they say it so that we don't have to take responsibility ourselves.
Yeah.
And actually the role of the leader is to try to subvert that logic, to push back so that but the priest refuses priesthood to create a priesthood of all believers. Mm-hmm. So to get you to take responsibility for your own beliefs and your own actions.
Yeah.
So that's part of what I see the leader's role is. Like an analyst is there not to be an analyst but to push back so as they analyse and interpret for themselves. But so the church for me has a number of features. One, it should create a space.
Yes.
Where we lay down our interpretations, where we engage symbolically in the self. Whenever Christ self-emptied, mm-hmm. and God is what's called kenosis in theology, we engage in the self-emptying. There is neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female. There is neither CNN nor Fox News. There is neither Democrat nor Republican. When we enter into the liturgical hour, we symbolically lay aside those things mm-hmm. and we enter the eschaton. We enter this. We step out of historical time and we enter into the last time. The end time. Now, when we do that, we then can invite this transformation to take place. So that's one role, I think, within the church. The second is that through the liturgies and the songs, they express the full range of human emotions, like the Psalms.
Mm-hmm.
From joy and love through to anger and pain. So it's a place where all of that can be expressed. And thirdly, that we engage in rituals and sacraments and liturgical actions which help to mould us into the type of people we want to be. As I said earlier, the point is not to convince you in church that you should be a nicer person. The point is not to convince you that you should give more to the poor. You know that. The point, but as I say, when you leave that space, you're not a nicer person and you don't give more to the poor. The point of engaging in sacrament and ritual and liturgy is that we symbolically enact the type of person we want to be so that whenever we leave that place, we become that.
Mm.
In other words, we are liturgical beings. What we do in the world, what we buy, what we drink, where we go, helps to mould who we are. And the church offers an alternative liturgical space where we engage in rituals that help us to refocus who we want to be.
Mm. Then how... I know this comes out of my background... as I've learned to live more comfortable in the ambiguities and not always having answers or seeing things right away, but I think it's part of our consumeristic culture. We want to see, we're results oriented. We want to see it. So if someone were to say to you, well, how do you know then that you're seeing transformation? What are the signposts along the way? What would you say to that person?
Yeah. Well, I'd say this is the problem. I mean, whenever I think that something, I look at some of what I thought in the past, what I thought was good, and then I go, my goodness, now I don't think it's good. Some of the things that I thought were really worth fighting for whenever I was 17 or 18, I go, oh my goodness, did I really think those were worth fighting for? Now, as a 35-year-old. So for me, all of whenever we try to actually talk about what is justice, what is good, mm-hmm. we're always open to making mistakes. So that's a human project. We have to do that together, communally. We have to work out what is the best thing to do in society at this time, politically and socially. That's a human construct. But the impetus to be good, the impetus to be just, to be loving, to show mercy, that's grace. That's the undeconstructible for Derrida. That's the transformation in Christianity. That's the rebirth. And so, in a sense, if someone says to me, if this is the question you're asking, it's like, okay, if you're not certain what the right thing to do is, then how can you act at all? I go, well, love doesn't need certainty. Love acts when there's uncertainty. Love acts because it has to. In love not only acts beyond certainty, i.e. if you have to give a flower on Valentine's Day for someone you love, if that's the kind of the romantic law, then love says, I'll give two flowers. Mm-hmm. I'll give more. Love always says, what must I do, and does more. But love also says, even if I don't know what I have to do, I'm going to do something. Mm-hmm. I have to act. You know, that whenever we're out in the street and we can give money to Oxfam or Christian Aid or to someone who's on the street begging, or we can keep it in our pocket, right? We have to act. We have to do one of those things, mm-hmm. you know? And do I sit down and calculate which is the right answer? Or do I have to act in uncertainty and give to one? As soon as I give to one, I'm not giving to the others. Or if I keep it, I'm not giving to anybody.
Yeah.
The point is, you act in the midst of uncertainty. And Derrida explains it like this. He says, the law, the legal system, is attempting to be just. At its best, is attempting to be just. But every time we write a law down, it fails to be just. It's unjust to somebody. Until we rewrite the law. So we're always rewriting the law, mm-hmm. trying to kind of make it just, realising that it never will be just. So in other words, without the law, we wouldn't know what justice is. But the law is never just. The law, the justice then is the undeconstructible, that which drives us to write the law. And the law always falls short and fails.
Mm.
So my point is not to kind of wait till we are certain that we know what to do before doing it. I go, whenever you're reborn in God and your impetus is to love, you act. But you must act always in fear and trembling. And you know what? You could act in a wrong way.
Yeah, but I guess your motive is trying to be in a loving way.
Yes.
That's always been my struggle with homeless people. I don't have money to give to everyone. How do I give to one? Or am I going to contribute to a drinking or a drug problem? But then that should be between them. That's their, in some sense, that's their business. But then I question, well, is it loving, though, to give them, to enable them in a bad, mm-hmm. hurtful behavior towards themselves?
Yeah.
You know?
And that process is exactly what I mean. I mean, you've got the desire to do good. So that's me, the rebirth.
Yeah.
And then you're trying to work out, well, you know, is that contributing to drug and alcohol problems? What's the right thing to do? That is human. And that's where you need, and I need to go and talk to someone who's an expert in this area, who works in the area of homelessness. That's where we need to get the evidence and we need to work out what's best. And we may do the wrong thing. You might give $10 or $20 to a guy and that guy goes out, buys alcohol and is put in hospital. And is put in hospital directly because of your $20. You acted out of love, but actually maybe you didn't do the necessary research. Or just that's what happens.
Yeah.
That's what I mean by always acting in fear and trembling. There's no certainty. Whenever it comes to doing the right thing.
Yeah.
But it's the impetus to ask those questions.
Yeah.
That's what's key. That's what's God.
When I was living in Los Angeles, there's a great burger joint out there called In-N-Out Burger, the best fast food burgers. And I went there one day for lunch, and this African-American homeless man approached me and said, which is very common out there in parking lots and gas stations, they'll come up and say, can I clean your windows? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you give them some money. And I was like, no, I'm really not interested. So I went in and I actually thought, well, he doesn't have to do anything for me. I bought him a burger and a Coke and French fries, a meal, and I took it out to him. And he's like, oh, thank you so much. He was so appreciative. So I went back in and had my lunch, and all of a sudden I look over and there's this group of people at the window looking out to the parking lot. And I was like, they're like, oh my gosh, look at this guy. And I'm like, what's going on? And I go over and I look out. The guy is taking his squirt bottle and his squeegee, and he's washing my entire car because I bought him the meal.
Wow.
You know, and I'm more likely to do that, buy a meal for someone, than just hand them money. I think that's something more tangible. Mm. It may not always be what they want, but... Yeah. But, yeah, you know, that was that moment. Mm-hmm. What, might I do something different in another moment? Might I just give them $5 or say, yeah, clean my window? Yeah. But those are the kind of things I wrestle with. And I'm not telling that story to
that's a great story.
To pump myself up. It wasn't anything I did. But that's kind of going, that idea of going the extra mile.
Yeah.
You know, on his end, it wasn't me.
Yes.
I was humbled by it.
Oh, yeah. No, that's beautiful. And that's it. I mean, we act, and we act because we have to act. We act because we want to, because there's this, you know, this side of us that we want to give, because we've been transformed, and we don't know what's going to happen as a result. And that's why, you know, the Bible says, it's not good to have zeal without knowledge. You know, I'm not a big fan of going, people go, oh, let's just, I want to be loving. I don't care about reading up on what I should be doing. You know, it's all about love. It's all about love. And people who say, you know, every time I click my fingers, you know, three people die. You know, the answer is stop clicking your fingers, first of all.
Yeah.
But apart from that, it's going like, so it's almost like, you know, there's not enough time to sit around and think, well, how can we change society? Because there's so much that needs to be done. Let's just go out and do it. I go, no, sometimes there's so much bad inside that we do need to sit and we do need to read and we do need to reflect about how our love actually becomes practice.
Yeah.
So how do we change structures? So there are lots of Christians during the time of slavery. There's forms of slavery today, but in America in the past, who said we should be kind to slaves. You know, Jonathan Edwards counseled his slaves, was very good to them, called mm-hmm. them by their first names. But it was Jonathan Edwards' son who said, no, let's not be nice to slaves. Let's question why they were slaves in the first place.
Mm. And they took it a step further.
But that's the difficult question. That's the question which brings, you know, which questions the whole economic system at the time, the questions the whole structure at the time. That requires reflection. It requires intelligence. It requires sitting down and actually thinking. So there's a real responsibility for many Christians for us to think, what is the best thing to do about homelessness? It's not just about giving $5. That can be it, but it's also about asking the questions of why they are homeless in the first place.
That's what I ask. How can we be one of the wealthiest nations in the world and we have homeless people?
Yeah.
I was just hearing a news story the other day about Japan. They don't have homeless people in Japan. I didn't know this.
Yeah.
But because of this whole economic thing that's worldwide, they're in the first time people are starting to lose their homes. They're losing their jobs. And their first time, they're starting to have homeless people in Japan.
Wow.
And it is. I think sometimes it is the questions. We're not asking the right questions. And I've been the nasty person who has just given the glib answer that, why don't they just go get a job? They can get a job at McDonald's. They provide uniforms for you. Why don't they just do that? I think they're just, they don't want to work. Then there are people who... And that was wrong of me, I think. I mean, in some sense, I think it was wrong of me. But there are people. I've talked to homeless people. They like being homeless. They can make. They don't have the constraints of paying bills. The consumerism hasn't gotten. In some sense, I think they have a little bit of a view that more of us could take, not being caught up in consumerism, and having all these responsibilities that in some sense they're more nomadic, you know. And
well, interestingly, there's a guy, Kieran O'Reilly, Catholic worker, and whenever the phrase make poverty history came along, he used the phrase make poverty voluntary. And I thought that was a really interesting thing to say, because what he was saying was, you know, make poverty voluntary in the sense that if you choose to have very little and to live very little, as long as it's your choice and it's not imposed upon you.
Exactly.
Because the original cynics, they voluntarily gave up all of their money and they lived, they were called cynics because it means to lead a doggish life. And, you know, they found such freedom in having very little and living very little. But the point is they chose it. They freely chose it. Today, most homeless people don't choose to be homeless.
Exactly.
It is imposed upon them. But you are right. There are some people, and there's a lot of, in the religious tradition, monks and nuns who voluntarily choose poverty. The cynics were a philosophical group who voluntarily chose poverty. And, you know, there will always be some people who choose that lifestyle, and they could be right. The problem is when poverty is imposed and not voluntarily chosen, and most people, it is not voluntarily chosen, as you know, it's imposed.
When I first moved to L.A., a friend told me that, you know, there's the big thing out there in L.A., getting on the freeways, they have lights to to control traffic flow onto the freeway. Mm-hmm. And so you stop, they'll have two lanes getting on to go on the freeway, and it's staggered, so it'll be a red light, you wait. So homeless people will often stand there and with their signs and get money. And I was like, what are they doing? And this friend told me, they said, well, if you think about it, people will give them a dollar. They can almost make a dollar a minute. So they're making like $60 an hour. You know, they're making good money. Why would they want to go out and work in a job, you know, when they're making their own hours and they're making money? And I'm like, yeah, sometimes that I considered, maybe I should become homeless.
Although, no, because the problem with all of that, yes, is they've got no, you know, health care.
Exactly.
No, yeah, so that's
exactly.
All pretty bad. I mean,
I know.
But these are, and that's why, in one sense, we need both the transformation of Christ, where we go to church and we are transformed, and we invite, we solicit, we recall the event which transforms us, right? And we engage in practice. So we need, that's vital. We go
yes.
to church and we invite and we solicit that further conversion. You know, we're
yes.
we're further conversion. But then, equally important, is that we then go out and we read and we reflect on how that becomes concrete. You know, the bread and the wine that we consume on a Sunday morning, we ask, how do we become bread and wine to those who mm-hmm. are in the world? You know, that's the question we have to ask. The baptismal water that we see on a Sunday morning in church, how do we become that water of life to those people around us? And so we require both that transformation, that grace moment, and we also need to read. We need a book in our hands, you know. So.
Mm. And I do see communities here in America that aren't just Sunday mornings or Sunday evenings, just that event when they meet, that they are going out throughout the week and living
yeah.
that out as God lives in the world.
Yes.
And it's always, but it always seems to be, you see this like in anything, it's always, it seems to be like 20% doing 80% of the work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a smaller amount, and it's like, I don't know, you know, even if you do create the spaces for people to have that doubt and that, will that grow that percentage, do you think? You know, if more and more churches were doing that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, do you see in Icon, do you see people, because they have that space to question and doubt and look at ambiguities and discuss that, do you see them, that freeing them then to go out and be as if God is in?
I don't know. I mean, I was at a conference recently and somebody asked, they said, you know, this whole emergent stuff, you know, it doesn't seem to be bringing in many new converts. And so some of the people on the panel were trying to answer that, and there was an issue that they acknowledged. And my response was, yeah, this exactly, you know, this emergent stuff should be trying to shrink the churches. This is not about church growth. This is about church shrinking. You know, we need to kind of ask very serious questions about why people go to church. You know, it's almost as if, oh yeah, everyone who goes to church at the moment, right, they're the Christians, and then we've got to grow them even more. But I'm going like, no way. How many people are in the church just because that's what you do as a good American? You go to church on a Sunday, you have your job, it is that, you have your family. And actually, being at church is just one part of being a citizen. It's not anything about transformation. You're not really there because you're inviting this transformative rupture to take place in your life, which will actually transform what you do for a living, whether you know, what you drive, what you wear, where you live.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't want that. So I go, my goodness, well, let's shrink the churches. And that's why I engage in what I call strategic denials. And a strategic denial is like this, where you would do something like nihilism for Lent. For Lent, you would ask the church and everybody to fully immerse themselves in the idea that there is no God, that life is meaningless, that everything will turn to dust and will turn to nothing, that everyone we love will pass, that everything we create will eventually become absolutely nothing. And then we ask, well, do we still love? Are we still do we still care? Or are we just doing this Christian life because we think it's pie in the sky when you die, because of what it can give us? Or actually, are we in this because of something so much deeper? And that's a strategic denial. And I think if we do more nihilism for Lent, you know, we'll shrink the churches.
Yeah.
Fantastic. We'll get to the places, those people who are genuinely going, you know, I have all these doubts, uncertainties, and ambiguities, but I live as though God exists. I am transformed by God. I want to live that in the world. That's what I'm interested in.
That's what I'm trying to do, although I fail miserably more than I get it right. But that's where I've come in my journey, in that the doubt, the ambiguity, the questions, more than the certainty, and having everything figured out and everything, you know, this is the answer to A, B, C, and D. And I think that what I see, people who are kind of jumping on the emergent or emerging church bandwagon here in America, is they're seeing it as church numbers are down, and this is something new to try to liven up the church and to bring more people in.
Yes.
And it becomes about church growth.
Terrible. It's the biggest danger to this movement, I think. One of the biggest dangers to this movement is that it's a neo-evangelical, crypto-evangelistic mission movement. What's exciting to me about the most radical elements of this emerging stuff is not that it's trying to do mission in a better way, but it's actually asking the question, what is mission? It's not trying to do church in a cooler way. It's not all about getting tea lights and stones into the church, as if the problem has been we've got a lack of stones and tea lights, you know? Let's bring the kids in, let's have flashing lights and video projectors. No. This is about rethinking what is church in a new context. What does it mean to be mission? What is it? These are the questions that it's asking. It's a theological movement, and my concern is that parts of the church are trying to see it simply as youth work or as a little missionary element of the wider church, rather than this thing that feeds back, that short circuits, that asks us what is church in the first place.
Would you say they're trying, in your term that you would use, to colonialize it? Are they trying to colonialize the emerging church? Or is that not...
I don't know. I mean, the terminology I would use is they're seeing... There's three ways, I think. Some people are seeing it as just the latest way of getting kids in, getting people into the church. And that, I think, does cover over and mask some of the genuine theological insights that this movement has. There are some who see it as a renewal movement, as an attempt to return to the early church, the church before, you know, either Plato, before, you know, Greek philosophy got it, or before power, before Constantine got it, or even the church before Paul, you know, where Jesus. But that's what the church has always been about. There's nothing new to that. There are some who say that the emerging church is not returning, it's not returning to the early church, it's returning to the event which gave birth to the early church. It's attempting to, you know, invite that event to rebirth here and now, and to create something that is both part of the tradition and also rethinks that tradition.
And that's where you would fall in that third?
Yeah, that's what I'm interested in, you know. I do quite like the renewal aspect as well, but no, that's not what I'm doing. I'm in the Reformation element.
Yeah, do you... there's talks in publishing. I mean, people have been talking how this whole... emerging church thing is kind of dead in the water. It's run its course.
Yeah.
Even people are saying postmodernism, that's dead in the water, that's run its course. What are your thoughts on all of that?
I think all of that talk is absolutely nonsense, both ways. You know, the problem is these terms are bandied about to sell books and t-shirts and coffee mugs. The terms is useful. It's useful to name something. I want to go into a supermarket and have labels on the food. It's going to take me a lot less time to do my shopping with labels, you know. So I think there are labels. And so sometimes I will say, use these terms like emergent or emergence or emergent. However, I can understand why people are getting sick of them, because it almost is a way to sell stuff.
Yeah.
And we should really let history judge what a movement's going to be called after the fact. Existentialists hated to be called existentialists. Postmodern philosophers hated to be called postmodern philosophers. Emergent people hate to be called emergent people. Because you go like, you know, the first to do something, that you're not, you put it like this way, Margaret Thatcher wasn't a Thatcherite. Karl Marx wasn't a Marxist. Christ wasn't a Christian. That's what the disciples do. They make what you live into a system. But when you're living it, it's not a system, it's what you're living.
Yes.
And then it later becomes a system. So what people are trying to do is they're trying to create a system out of something that is currently embryonically being born. This is the beginning, not the end. It's hilarious that people are beginning to try and say something's dead when this is just at its very embryonic form. It's been around for less than 100, 200 years. And that In philosophy, it's very, very young. In fashion, you know, if it's like if it's 10 months old, it's out of date. Philosophy, less than 200 years, that's pretty new.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's... And you get people who are publishing and you know, it's... What's the next... I think, like, what's publishing fashion, what's the next big fad?
Yeah. I mean, it's like these music magazines. You know, every month there's a new front cover, the new next big thing.
Yes.
But we all know that's ridiculous. In 10 or 15 years... when we've got some distance, we'll look back at this time and there'll be a few bands that will be remembered and the majority won't.
But look how everything becomes retro in 20 years. I mean, here we're in 2000 and, you know, it was the late 90s. 80s music that I listened to in high school became retro again.
Yeah.
Then we have these 70s parties, you know, where we dress up in 70s clothes. It becomes back in the swing of fashion again.
But it takes a long time for the good stuff to arise. That's all I'm saying is, you know, it'll take maybe 100 years before we'll look back at this time and we'll go like, here are the half dozen bands that made a real difference, you know, and everything else will go to ground. You know, who knows, this emerging stuff, it might be dead in the ground, it may not, but we won't know. Let the people in 100 or 200 years judge. You know, you've got to live as though it will make a difference, even though you kind of know. Like I know this probably won't make any difference at all. What I'm doing probably won't last. I know that, but I've got to live as if it will.
Yes.
I've got to live as though this is the most important thing. You know, in fact, I think it's sometimes important to go, I'm going to lose this. Of course this is not important. Of course this is not relevant. Of course this is just a little blip. But still I live as if it isn't. I live fully as if it isn't. And the reason is because if you can say, I'm going to fight this battle knowing I'm going to lose, mm-hmm. and you still fight it, you've already given up everything in order to fight the battle. You've given up everything. And so therefore you may just win.
Yeah.
Because that's the kind of sacrifice that it requires.
Yeah.
You know? And if we don't fight for it, it ain't going to happen.
I'm just sitting here thinking about Mother Teresa. You know, I think she lived as if she would make a difference. I know she made a difference, but... did a lot. How far did it change in poverty in India? But I don't know what inside her mind. I can't imagine being inside her mind, but I would think she lived as if it mattered and she was going to make a difference and make an impact.
I think it's the exact opposite. I think that Mother Teresa, from her letters, she was living, going, this probably doesn't make any impact at all. I don't know if God's there. I don't know why I'm doing this. But she thought that. But she lived as though it did make a difference.
That's what I'm saying.
So she lived,
as if it made a difference.
Lived as though
she
it
may
made
not
a
have believed it did, that. But she lived.
Yeah. And that's what's key. So I go like, I don't know. You know, that's why I say it's ridiculous both ways. You know, we'll say, oh, the emergent's the next big thing, or emergent is dead. I go, let's history judge. Let your children's children judge that.
What do you say about the people like, you know, Andrew Jones, tall, skinny Kiwi? He doesn't use the term. I think he's gotten away from using emergent or emerging.
Yeah.
And there's still Emergent Village. There's the conversations. There's the cohorts. But so what is the next term then that people are going to use? Here I am. I've been a part of this conversation a better part of 10 years, and I created Queer Emergent trying to give a safe space for people to explore these issues, kind of like, you know, what you're saying, the doubts, the questions. Mm-hmm. And it's, a play on words with queer and with emergent, because emergent to me has been those places where people are trying to explore. And I thought, if it's dead in the water, then what am I doing? But I that's what I did. I'm going on as if I'm trying to live as if... you know, maybe I struggle and doubt that, but I'm trying to live as if it is a place. And
who knows? I mean, if this movement is significant in 200 years, maybe it will be termed the emergent movement. Maybe it won't. Maybe another word will have cottoned on. Who knows? But yeah, let's use the term. The point is just not to hold that tightly to it. Either way, that's what I love about these emergent cohorts, people like yourself, is we use the term, but nobody's holding on to it that tightly.
Exactly.
Everybody's going like, you know, let our children's children judge. Let history judge. We'll use this term, but it's what's more important is what's going on beneath the term.
Yes.
You know, what's going on and that's what's important. There are values that are being expressed. Because here's the deal. Every religious movement, every movement really, but it arises to solve a problem or a series of problems that the previous movement could not solve in its own terms.
Mm-hmm.
So a new theological movement arrives and it solves the problems of the past, but it then creates its own problems. And some of those problems it can solve within its own terms, mm-hmm. through quantitative changes, change bits and pieces. But every now and again, eventually it will create problems that it cannot solve within its own terms. And then we call that a reformation. That's a qualitative change.
Okay.
And those happen. Phyllis Sickle talks about it. She says, you know, it's approximately every 500 years in history you can see that some sort of qualitative change has happened, a reformation has taken place. And what the wager is at the moment is that modern theology, it answered lots of problems that other theologies in the past couldn't answer.
Mm-hmm.
But it has generated its own problems. For example, it doesn't seem to have the resources to bring liberal and conservatives together under the same roof. Doesn't seem to have the resources to deal with kind of environmental crisis. Doesn't have the resources to deal with the issues of sexual ethics and gender issues. And so emerging theology is an attempt to address those problems within a new paradigm. But it will, in 500 years' time or less, it'll create problems that it won't be able to address within its own terms. And then it will require a new generation to then try and answer those questions with a new paradigm.
Yeah. You know, it's I've heard people accuse emergent or emerging, you know, this whole conversation is just, it's like the hippies of the 60s or you know, rethinking, like the Jesus movement, or that it's just the same old liberal theology in new clothing.
Yeah.
Where I'm kind of thinking that what you're talking about, the whole paradigm shift in how we look at things, not looking at Christianity as a worldview, that kind of goes beyond those liberal or conservative,
yeah,
you know, Jew or Greek kind of thing.
Yes.
It kind of breaks that mold. I mean, I think labels sometimes are necessary evils because we're limited human beings in our language and we're trying to put language to things.
Yeah.
But what you're saying, I think, tries to go beyond that.
It tries to find something. I'm trying to develop a theology that can allow differences in terms of our theological and philosophical positionings.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we encounter each other at a deeper level, and we can find unity as something much more primordial. That's the role. And so, and I've seen this happen. I mean, I recently published a small piece on my blog, which has said, you know, the title was "I Deny the Resurrection," and it was a question I was asked in Calvin College. You know, does my theoretical position undermine the resurrection of Christ? And the answer I gave at the time was, yes, I fundamentally admit that I deny the resurrection of Christ, without equivocation, without hesitation. You know, and anyone who knows me well will tell you that. And I said, you know, I deny the resurrection of Christ every time I do not serve at the feet of the poor, every time that I turn away from those who are homeless, every time I participate in an unjust system. Now, what was interesting about that was that both liberal and conservative blogs took that on and embraced it. So conservative bloggers were saying, you know, really like this because it caught me out, it convicted me. You know, I was thinking, oh, denial of the resurrection, and then realised, yes, absolutely. It's not just some sort of lip service. I can't just say Jesus is Lord. It has to be lived in my life. And people from liberal perspective were saying, you know, they liked this because it showed that the kind of historicity of the gospel isn't of primary importance. Now, again, I was interested because both, that was a theology that we could unify in. And then, of course, the debates come in, because on the conservative side, they want to say, of course, but we still affirm a literal resurrection. And on the liberal side, they want to say, you know, we don't affirm that, or we don't need to affirm that. So those debates happen. But where we all are unified on is, good grief, yeah, absolutely, we don't affirm the resurrection if we don't become the site where resurrection takes place. So there you've got the unity. And then we can fight. And I have nothing against fighting. In fact, I love fighting. I'm Irish. You know, we love a good fight. And that's why the Irish are so close to God. You know, because to be Israel is to fight with God, to fight. So I'm all for let's have the big fights. But then I go, but where do we unify?
Yes.
Well, we unify in the sight that our theology should be performative. It should do something. We should be transformed by it. And an icon, we have liberal and we have conservative sitting side by side, fighting diversity, all of that, but also unified in the sense of this has to change who I am on a Monday morning.
Yeah. And, you know, some people are, I'll say things and they'll say, well, but, you know, I have to agree to disagree with you, and I respect that you have your belief on XYZ. Mm-hmm. And then someone comes back to me and says, well, I don't think you are being really genuine in that. And I'm like, no, I really am. I think that some people you are going to hold their beliefs so tight. I don't so much. I admit that. Maybe I'm wrong and I'm missing it, but I'm trying to live my life as if, I guess it goes back to what you're saying, as if God is in the world and I don't have all the certainties, but I'm trying to live my life as best I know.
Yes, yes.
Kind of thing.
So in other words, you live as though God exists, in the sense of you try to live with conviction, you try to live with passion, you try and live from that incarnational place, but then you have all of the doubts. You go, you know, I don't know for sure what's going on.
Maybe that other person is right.
Yeah.
They have that right to that view. But just treat people with respect is what I would say.
Yeah.
In your views that you have, don't be hatred or unloving. And
people might say the response to this is sometimes, oh, this is just works-based kind of religion. But fundamentally, it's not at all. In fact, works-based religion is you do something because God exists, because there's a heaven, because you don't want to go to hell. That's works-based, because you're doing something to get something in return. That's how work works.
The transactional.
It's an economy. So yes, if you're doing something to get something back, then that's a works-based faith. The faith that I'm talking about is where we act not to get something, but because we simply have to, because it's part of who we are, because Christ has been born within us, because the transformation has taken place. And it's not to get something, it's because we can't do otherwise. That's not works-based. That's living out of the light of this transformation.
That's great.
And of course, not knowing whether the transformation is just something psychological or God or whatever. And I go like, in ICON, most people, say 70% believe that God exists, but they're open to going, but maybe God doesn't. And maybe 30% say, I don't think God does exist. And they go, but maybe God does. So you say to the people who don't believe in God in ICON, why do you go? They go, because God spoke to me. Don't be so stupid. You know, of course, because God spoke. You go like, but you're not sure if God exists? No, but I'm certain God spoke to me. Oh yeah, my life has been transformed. I was blind and now I can see, you know. But as to whether Jesus is a sinner or not, whatever, I don't know. I'm not sure. But I'm absolutely convinced that something's happened in my life. Why am I convinced? Because I'm sitting in this pub, engaging in this ritualistic activity and trying to live like Christ. Something must have happened, you know.
That's beautiful. Right. So, what's next in the life of Pete Rollins?
Oh well, I'm publishing a new book. It comes out next week, 1st of March, called "The Orthodox Heretic and Other Impossible Tales," and that's a book that is trying to explore, theology is performative. It's 33 parables and 33 commentaries, and I love parables because they're not there to convince the mind. They're not there to tell you what to think so much as to convict and challenge you and transform you. So every different religious traditions have these different techniques. So in Buddhism you've got koans, and in Jewish tradition you've got these midrash stories. In Christianity you've got parables. Parables are performative discourses that are supposed to do something to you. And I'm excited about this because I wanted to write a book that was popular, that was could be understood by a wide range of people, but that didn't dumb down, didn't patronise. And I realised, well, parables are a good way of doing it. Because in a parable, you can read it at a basic level if it's your first time approaching it, if you're just new to all of this. Or you can read it at an advanced level if you've got a lifetime of experience behind you.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I do. And I'm also then currently writing a book that's based kind of, or starting from some of Bonhoeffer's later writing on worldly Christianity and religionless Christianity.
Oh, brilliant. I haven't really read Bonhoeffer.
Oh, yeah. Well, the later Bonhoeffer is particularly interesting.
Is that post-Cost of Discipleship?
Or? Yeah. I'm thinking the Letters and Papers is where I think it starts to get really interesting.
Okay.
But sadly, he's executed before he can develop that theology in much depth. I'm also hopefully going to spend a lot more time in America in the next year, and I want to help some of these groups, like ICON, these emergent groups, kind of develop.
That's so cool.
Committed to that as well, and doing the speaking thing and writing.
That's great. I wanted to ask you about real quick about Bonhoeffer. I saw a play one time where he was about him attempting to be part of a movement that was going to try to assassinate Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was a true story.
Oh, yes.
It was.
Yeah. That's why he was in prison.
Prison for that?
And was executed for it, yeah.
How does that... That, to me, shakes, especially in evangelical Christian circles, you know, to me, that I'm like, oh, my gosh, why would he do that? That seems to go against what Christ was about. And then I think about Pat Robertson, who's called for our government to assassinate Hugo Chavez down in Venezuela. What are your thoughts on that kind of...
Yeah, but Bonhoeffer was a committed pacifist, and, you know, he never really renounced that, as far as I can see. What happened was simply he was faced with a situation where he felt it was so horrific that he needed to act. And this is why, again, he's such an interesting character. He still was a pacifist, and he believed, you know, that blood would be in his hands. He didn't do it lightly. But he just felt that he had to really engage in that sin, that transgression, mm-hmm. because of the horror of what was going on around him.
Yeah, he was going more where the Catholic Church was pulled totally away and kind of was complicit
that time. And the Protestant Church as well. I mean, it was Jehovah's Witnesses were one of the few religious movements that really stood defiant.
Really? I never knew that.
And then the very small bunch called the Confessing Church.
And what was that film we watched where at the end the priest...
Oh, Amen.
Amen, it's a beautiful film.
Yes.
Where he got on the train with the Jews.
Yes, that's a beautiful film to watch. That's something I talk about in How Not Speak of God, that's right.
Yeah. Well, cool. That's great. I really thank you for your time and wish you well. And thanks for spending time this weekend with us.
Thanks very much. I've loved it. Thank you.
It was great. And have a safe trip home.
Thanks.
I'm not afraid to die. Thanks for listening to the Something Beautiful podcast. Join us again next week at somethingbeautifulpodcast.com.